From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, California, this is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro.
Temple Grandin joins us this week. Dr. Grandin is well known for her personal experience with autism and also knows a lot about non-human animals. Her new book, written with Katherine Johnson, is called Animals Make Us Human, and it's a fascinating look at the way we live with our animals and how we can make life better for them and have better relationships with them. So, Temple Grandin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's great to be here.
Dr. Grandin, why do you think we have pets?
Well, pets provide a lot of companionship. I mean, like I can tell you when I was a kid, I mean, dogs are really fun to play with. There's a lot of good reasons for having pets.
Has it always been, I mean, I know you've studied, but how far back do pets go?
Well, I think they go back a long, long way.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Irene Pepperberg was on the show a couple of weeks ago, and she's the scientist who worked with the African gray parrot named Alex.
Yep, I know her really well.
She's great. And she said that leaving an African gray alone all day was the same as leaving a four-year-old child in a playpen all day.
Well, and I get very concerned about all the dogs that are home alone all day.
I was just going to ask you that. Are we torturing our dogs by leaving
them? I think it depends upon the dog. Some dogs tolerate being home alone a lot better than others. But there's some that if they're whining all day or they're licking their paw or doing some damage themselves or they're chewing the door trying to get out, you're going to need to do something. Either get another dog, maybe take it to a doggy daycare or leave it off at a neighbor that's home during the day. But there's, dogs are very, very social and they don't like being alone.
Does it help if you put the radio on or something like that?
I think that would help. I mean, I was just talking to somebody just today where their dog really liked to watch the TV, especially animal shows. That would probably help, but that's not substitute for companionship with another human or another dog. And getting very concerned that, dogs today in the controlled life that they have, they don't get to have a doggy social life. I mean, when I was a little kid in the 50s, all the dogs ran around loose, and the bad thing was dogs got hit by cars. But we didn't have all the behavior problems, all the serious dog fights and bites, because the dogs were well socialized to other dogs, and they were also very well socialized to all different kinds of people and socialized to children, which is really, really important.
Well, so now there's been several generations, because now we're more afraid of letting our dogs run around because there's a lot more traffic. So now there's been sort of several generations of dogs who have been kept isolated from other dogs. Has that changed the species, do you think?
Well, I think it's caused problems with socialization. I mean, in Fort Collins, where I live, they've got draconian leash laws, and there's a cop that goes around on a bike giving out $75 tickets if you're outside with your dog off a leash and if you're right there with it. And so in order to get dogs socialized, you're going to have to spend a lot more work doing this, socializing puppies to other puppies, socializing adolescent dogs to well-socialized adult dogs, getting dogs socialized to toddlers. It's extremely important to get dogs socialized to toddlers because we want to make sure that dog views toddlers and young children as people, not as prey.
there are a lot of programs and books about dog training and common dog problems like toilet training and biting and things like that. What are your thoughts on dog training?
Well, there's a lot of controversy about Cesar Millan, and we write about him in our book, Animals Make Us Human. With the aggressive dogs, the aggressive kind of problems with dogs, I mean, Caesar's methods seem to work, calm and confident, be the leader sort of thing. But his methods do not work if the problem's separation anxiety or fear. He's had some hideous episodes, especially with dogs that were fearful of things. See, and this gets back to when you're working on solving a behavior problem, you've got to figure out which emotional system in the brain is driving it. And fear and separation anxiety and aggression, they're three totally different things, and they're driven by different brain systems.
What drives separation anxiety, for instance?
Well, there's actually circuits in the brain for separation anxiety. In the first chapter of Animals Make Us Human, Katherine Johnson and I review the research Jack Penskep on what's called the core emotions in the subcortex of the brain in all mammals, and their fear. And this has been fully mapped. It's been in the neuroscience research literature for years. Separation anxiety or panic rage, and then seeking. That's just the urge to explore. Like some dogs are high seekers. They got to run around a lot. They got to sniff everything. And there's other dogs that are more content to kind of lay around. And they're different emotional systems.
So what about crate training? What do you think about that?
I think it's a good idea to teach a dog that being in a crate's a good place. They can travel in a crate. I think that's something you definitely want to do. But I'm concerned about people keeping dogs in crates for hours and hours and hours a day. That's like jail for dogs.
Right.
I mean, dogs need to be trained to travel in crates, and you want to make sure that the first experiences with the crate are good first experiences. You don't want the crate just associated with going to the vet or something. Let's just have it associated with treats in the beginning.
Uh-huh. And kind of leave it there for the dog to go in if they want to?
Well, that'd be one good way to start doing it. It's very important when you introduce something new to an animal, any animal, it doesn't matter what species of animal, that they have a good first experience with that new thing. If they have a scary, frightening first experience, you can sometimes get a fear memory. That's really difficult for the animal to overcome, and especially with a high-strung, nervous animal like the Arabian horse.
Yeah, I want to ask you about horses in a minute, and I happen to own an Arabian horse, so we'll talk about her in a second. But before we get to that, I want to ask you this. At one time, the definition of humans was that humans were the only animals who could conceive of things remote in time and space. And in other words, the thought was, well, when you're not with your dog or cat or horse or pig, that those animals can't picture you or can't think about you. Do you think
I think that's rubbish.
So you think they're fully capable of thinking of things remote in time and space?
To a limited amount. There's been some very interesting experiments with birds done at the University of California. I can't remember the scientist's last name, but her first name's Nikki. Mm-hmm. I read an article about her in a science magazine called Nikki and the Jays, and she found that jays were able to at least look, 24 hours into the future. And this experiment was what they call a cheap hotel room and the expensive hotel room, and consisted of three cages. The birds would be in the daytime. A cheap room with no food in it, the lobby of the hotel, and then another room that had food in it. And then the birds would be locked in one of the hotel rooms for the night. And the room with the food, that's the expensive hotel. It had breakfast is included. And if Jay could either be locked in the cheap hotel with no breakfast or locked in the expensive room with breakfast, and then during the day he's free to roam around everywhere. And the Jays quickly learned to move food out of the expensive room and put it in the cheap room so they'd have breakfast, they'd at least have some breakfast, no matter what room they got shut in.
Well, I guess that shows it, doesn't it? I want to ask you about my cat before we talk about horses. My cat, her name's Emu, and she listens to the show, so I wanted to give her a little shout-out there. But she is obsessed with sucking her toe. I mean, she sucks her toe a lot. She climbs up on my lap and then settles in and is... What's that all about? Why?
Well, that's not normal behavior. Hopefully she's not damaging her toe in any way.
No, I always check to make sure. That she...
Okay, good.
Why would a cat obsess in this way?
Well, sometimes animals obsess on things like that. Like a dog will lick its paw raw when he's left home alone. Separation anxiety. Now, is this a cat you've had from a kitten, or did you?
Yes, and in fact, she didn't start sucking her toe until she was like 2 years old. Then she suddenly began sucking her toe.
It's hard to say. One thing that's very, very important is that make sure she's not damaging her foot in any way.
Yeah, well, I do keep an eye on that. But I mean, is it common for cats to have obsessive behaviors like that?
Well, it's not common for them to suck their toes. Abnormal behavior, and we discussed that a lot in the first chapter of Animals Make Us Human, has an emotional, component to it. Like separation anxiety, you may get repetitive abnormal licking of the paw in dogs.
Mm-hmm.
In polar bears, you get, the seeking, they want to explore, but there's nothing to explore, so they just keep walking, walking, walking. The gerbil that's described in the first chapter is trying to dig, 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 and he doesn't care about digging. What he wants is cover, because there's an instinctual fear of aerial predators, and he wants to get under things.
That was very interesting.
Is motivating that, and...
You said in your book that if you provide the gerbil with a tube or a place to go hide, then they won't be digging.
That's right. In other words, it isn't the digging the gerbil wanted. What the gerbil wanted was the results of the digging, which would be a place of cover. All those little rodents, too, are the same way. They want to get cover because Otherwise, cat's going to eat them.
That made me feel so bad about all the little digging gerbils that are endlessly digging in their little cages. We're talking with Temple Grandin, and her new book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals. Well, let's talk about horses a little bit. And horses are, I guess, because they're so big, and they're far more likely to kill themselves, I think, than any of your other pets.
Horses as a species are higher fear than dogs are, because horses are a prey species animal, a dog's a predator. Now, there's a tremendous amount of variation, and a horse like an Arab gets scared more easily than some of the other more heavy-set kind of horses. And it's very important with a horse like an Arab to make sure that when you introduce something new to it, it's a positive first experience. Because if it has a really traumatic experience, let's say the first time he goes in the trailer, he falls on his butt, he may get a fear memory about trailers. And he may get afraid of something odd, like what he was looking at right at the time that he went over and fell on his butt and smacked his head. And if that was your blue pickup truck, now he's going to be afraid of blue pickup trucks.
So horses have a really strong memory for that kind of thing?
Yes, they have. And these fear memories are usually visual or auditory. And they also can make generalizations, like guys with beards are bad, or maybe guys are bad and ladies are good. And in the book, I describe one horse that got afraid of long-handled tools because he'd had an accident in the cross ties and the lead rope had fallen down along his stomach. And anything that was a long, skinny thing like that, he became afraid of.
Well, now, do you, I don't know, I think anthropologists spend a lot of time kind of rating animals' levels of intelligence. Do you care about that, or do you think animals...
Different animals are good at different things, and they're finding that certain birds, like the blue jays, the crows, are very intelligent, and pigeons maybe not so much.
Uh-huh. And you've done some work with birds. I mean, you've mentioned in your book, you mentioned poultry, for instance.
Yeah, poultry, they are not as smart as Alex the parrot, that's for sure.
I had a pet duck who seemed awfully smart.
Well, when we were kids, there was one of the kids got an Easter duckling, and it got imprinted to the dogs, and it went around all around the neighborhood as one of the dogs.
And I also had a horse that had a pet rooster.
Well, animals, poultry, when they're young, there's a real sensitive period where they'll imprint to some other living thing, or even something that's moving, and they think that's mama, and they just follow it around.
And what about horses? They like to have... I know thoroughbreds have had pet goats just to kind of keep them calm.
Well, animals, want companionship. I mean, a lot of horses are locked up in stalls all day, and they don't get to socialize with other horses. And I'm really concerned with dogs and horses and many animals that they're not getting enough of a social life, with their own kind. They get lonely.
Well, what can you recommend to horse owners in terms of... I guess the two big problems with keeping a horse is, keeping a horse is very expensive, and, what if you can't ride it? What do you suggest
people do?
Well,
if they can be out on a pasture with a whole other group of horses, that's often the best environment.
And how do you prevent horses from being lonely and miserable during the day?
Well, if he's out on a pasture with a bunch of other horses, he's not going to be lonely.
But if you have your prize Arab, you can't do that, right? Because
then you have to substitute something else to replace that. Like, it's the same thing with a dog that's home alone all day. Then you're going to need to spend at least an hour a day, walking and playing with it and making up for that lost time.
What do you think it is that makes horses so irrational? Is it that fear of...
Horses panic. Horses, when they get scared, they'll panic to the point where they get destructive to themselves in a way that a dog doesn't, because they're just much higher fear, because a horse is a prey species flight animal. And in the wild, they kick and they flee. And the Arab, in particular, gets scared and gets scared to the point where it can get into a complete panic a lot more easily than a dog would.
We're talking with Temple Grandin. Her book is called Animals Make Us Human, written with Katherine Johnson. They also wrote Animals in Translation, a wonderful book. You also write a lot about poultry. Animals that we eat, use for eating, like cows and those things. Are you a vegetarian, by the way?
No, I eat meat. In fact, I don't have a metabolism that doesn't function on a vegetarian diet. I get all hypoglycemic and lightheaded if I don't eat eggs or meat. But I feel very strongly we've got to give animals a decent quality of life, whether it's a food animal or whether it's a pet animal. I mean, a dog that's home alone and he's chewed his paw badly, that's not a good quality of life.
Right, but I mean, if we're going to raise an animal for the sole purpose of killing it and eating it, you're saying that that animal's life should be of high quality?
Well, he should have cattle. The beef animals got the best quality of life. I mean, the bulls and the cows are out on a ranch. They live outside. But actually, for pigs, there's going to be kind of two kinds of ways it's going to happen with the meat animals. You're going to have a lot of your buy local and your niche markets, but you're still going to have large scale commercial. And a lot of simple things can really help. I mean, already in California, sow stalls are going to get, phased out with Proposition 2. I think that needed to be done. But the other thing is pigs are rooters and manipulators. And even if they were living in a concrete building, if you could just give them some handfuls of straw to root in and manipulate, that will do a lot for a pig.
What do you think about keeping those animals as domestic pets?
Well, one of the problems even with the miniature pig, well, regular domestic pigs are going to get way too big. I mean, they just get huge.
Uh-huh.
And even with the miniature pigs, they still get really, really big. So then you've got the problem of keeping it on a diet, and then it's cranky and get a bad temper because you've had to keep it on such a diet. And even the so-called, miniature pigs still get very heavy. And I think, a dog or a cat would recommend.
There was a time, I guess it's not quite so common now, maybe there are laws to prevent it, but people did have exotic pets, ocelots and things like that as pets. What are your feelings about that?
Well, one of the problems you get into is when they grow up, they start to get really destructive, tear the house up. I think most people are going to be much better off just with regular dogs and cats, and there's lots of nice dogs and cats down at the animal shelter. And the animal shelters now are doing a much better job of, screening the temperament, to help match animals to the right kind of families and, match people with animals.
We're talking with Temple Grandin. Her book is called Animals Make Us Human. I went to the circus recently. Do you have any thoughts about circus animals?
Well, there's been controversies about how elephants are treated. And, and if elephants are being treated in a harsh manner, they just shouldn't be doing that. I don't know what's really going on.
Yeah. How about rodeos and things like that? Are you against them?
Well, bucking events, the bulls and the horses, those animals actually turn into a trained animal if you do it right. And they know when they're supposed to buck. And what's always amazed me about some of the bucking bulls is how they let the cowboys sit on them for 15 minutes before the gate opens. The event that I get the most concerned about is calf roping, because you jerk a calf up really hard, you hurt the calf.
Uh-huh.
And I was glad to see that they're going to no jerk down rule now in Colorado, because that hurts calves. And then when they say in the rodeo that's the way ranchers rope calves, that's a lot of rubbish. Good ranchers that do roping go very quietly in. They kind of just flip the loop over the calf, and he's not jerked around. It's done very quietly.
Well, you don't want to hurt your animal if you need it to live a long life, right?
No. On a well-run ranch, they don't do that. Also, a lot of ranchers just use a calf chute.
And what about zoos? Are you a fan of zoos? Are you anti-zoo? What's your?
I'm not anti-zoo, because I think that we got to get kids interested in the natural world. I mean, one of my big concerns today, and when we write about this in the book, is who's going to be the next Jane Goodall? And if kids don't see animals, they don't get interested in them. And the zoos are doing a much better job on providing better environments for animals. And there's some animals, like elephants, that unless you have a very big, extensive kind of zoo, they're hard to keep, and some zoos are phasing them out. Where there's a lot of other animals that, adapt just fine at the zoo. You've got to give the animal the thing that it, things that fit with its nature.
So that if you put animals with a water moat around them who are afraid of water, then their life will be miserable.
Well, you want to make sure that the animal has things to do. One really clever thing I've seen done with the large cats like tigers was giant cat toys, and the zoo strung a cable up across the zoo, and they'd hang boxes of meat on it, and they could slide them around, pull them up and down with pulleys, and the cat would play with it just like a house cat, and then they'd let the cat kill the box of meat and eat it.
Well, that sounds good. I want to just talk to you briefly about, you know, your career. They're making a movie. Claire Danes is going to play you in a movie.
Yeah, Claire Danes is going to play me. It's going to be coming out this spring. And she plays me in the 60s and 70s, and I was a lot more autistic acting than I am now. I had a chance to visit the set, and it was like going into a time warp back to the 60s and the 70s.
So are you you're participating in the making of this?
Well, I helped them out on the cattle things. In fact, they're going to reenact when I built one of my first projects, a cattle dipping vet. In fact, they built a full-scale working cattle dip vet off my original drawings. And I went down to see that. We went down there to make sure everything was working right with that. And, I was really impressed how Claire Danes played me. I had a chance to watch her do some scenes.
So, she's a fine actress.
And she's not going to look like Claire Danes, I'll tell you right now.
No? You guys don't look alike?
Well, they had put a wig on her.
When you say that you were more autistic acting.
Well, when the movie comes out, I'm much more, kind of talk kind of suddenly, and I was much more into, don't talk as fluid. And so you think about being an autistic person. I think in pictures, but you keep learning more and more and more, because I had to learn social skills sort of like being in a play.
Mm-hmm.
And being autistic helped me with my work with animals, because I think in pictures. I mean, animals don't think in language. You want to understand an animal, you got to get away from language.
Right, since they don't use language.
But they do think.
Do you think you're, I don't want to offend. I want to ask the question correctly. Has your autism gotten better, or is that not possible?
Well, you just always keep learning. We always constantly keep learning and learning and learning.
How do you think autism, being autistic, has helped you connect with animals? The idea that you both think
well,
in pictures?
Well, I think in pictures.
Uh-huh.
And an animal is a sensory-based thinker. You've got to imagine thought, and then their emotional things are linked to sensory-based memories. I mean, think about when the dog goes to the fire hydrant and sniffs the fire hydrant or the tree. He knows who's been there, how long ago they were there, are they a friend or foe, what's their social ranking. There's a lot of information on that tree when the dog checks it out. But it's sensory-based. It's not language-based.
Right. And do you think there's a difference then between instinct and intelligence?
Okay, let me just let's just do a little basic behavior 101.
Okay.
Emotional systems that are down in the base of the brain that are described in the first chapter of Animals Make Us Human, they're the drivers. They're the things that make motivate the animal to do stuff. Then you've got learned behavior. Okay, your dog learns that you come home at 5 o'clock, so he's waiting by the door at 5 o'clock. That's learned behavior.
Mm-hmm.
You can teach a dog stuff he can chase, things he's, cars he's not allowed to chase, ball he is allowed to chase. Then you have behaviors that are like hardwired little computer programs. Those are your instincts. Predator animals, like dogs, have a tendency to chase things that move rapidly. Now, what they direct that chasing behavior at is learned. When the dog wants to play, he puts his butt up in the air and he bows down. That's a play bow. That's learned behavior. When the dog kills the squirrel, I made a mistake there. When the dog does a play bow, that's an instinctual behavior.
Right.
It's a hard, I'm a little bit dyslexic. I mixed that up. I just said that backwards.
I understand.
But there's hardwired behaviors. Now, emotions drive those hardwired behaviors. And they're different in different species. Some animals view staring at them as a threat. And, chimpanzees, if you smile at them, that's threatening to them. Different species have different behaviors. If the dog kills the squirrel, the way it like grabs the squirrel by the neck and
shakes it,
bye bye squirrel.
Yeah,
that's a hardwired behavior. So that's the instinct part. But an animal and the emotions are like the drivers for both learned behavior and instincts.
So I guess that limits the kinds of behavior that they can learn.
Well, it's hard to train an animal totally against their nature. I mean, when I studied behavior in the 60s, everything was, B.F. Skinner, stimulus response. I talked about this in Animals and Translation.
Uh-huh.
And I said to B.F. Skinner, if we could learn about the brain, wouldn't that be wonderful? He said, you don't need to know anything about the brain. You've got, operant conditioning. Well, you can't train an animal to go against its nature. And there's a famous paper by Breelands and Breelands called The Misbehavior of Organisms, which is a takeoff on the name of Skinner's book, The Behavior of Organisms. And you can't train a chicken to work a key with its foot. You know, it's got to be set up so it pecks the key. You know, it's just too much against its nature. There was one experiment to try to train a raccoon to put pennies in a bank. Yeah, and it did it, but then it got into its little instinctual food-washing routine.
Mm-hmm.
And it would sit there rubbing and rubbing and rubbing the penny for a long time before it put it in the bank.
Yeah.
You see, that's where instinct, hardwired behavior, collided with what we were trying to teach it.
Right, since rubbing the penny is not going to make it any cleaner.
Well, it's not going to get it in the bank, and that's what they wanted the raccoon to do.
I see. Well, it's very fascinating, and the book is called Animals Make Us Human, Creating the Best Life for Animals, and the author, Temple Grandin. And I want to thank you so much for spending some time with us this week. What are you going to be working on next? What's your next book?
Well, right now I'm working on a book, more of a technical book, on practical animal welfare programs, mainly for farm animals.
Well, I hope you'll come back and talk to us about that.
Okay, well, thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's all the time we have for this week's From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at kusp.org. Thanks, as always, to our From the Bookshelf production staff, Miss Breanne Beal. Thanks, Breanne. Thanks for listening, everybody. From KUSP in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro. Bye-bye.